The world economy, you know, moves by giant container ships.
Why the urge to build bigger and bigger ships? Simple economics.
And how do you make a huge container ship?
We just have to bring in some 10, 12,000 steel plates, clean them, and cut them into some 120,000 pieces, and weld them together.
Simple words for big jobs. The global economy is a quiet ballet of huge things moving quietly and mostly at night. The poetry of the workplace when the economy doesn't exactly rhyme. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. It's Tuesday, June 2nd. I'm John Huckenberry. Coming up this hour, trying to imagine what happened to the mysterious Air France jet, which has still disappeared. Plus, panning for entertainment gold in the summer TV. They're not reruns. We've actually found some shows worth your time. That and GM, conflicts of interest for taxpayers. First, the headlines. In the headlines, a possible clue on the missing Air France flight turns out to be a dead end. Pilots reported flames on the water in the area the plane was flying in, but searchers now say there's nothing in that spot. Bad weather in the region is making searching for any of the survivors, if there are any, or any evidence of the wreckage, much harder. Bye-bye Hummer. There's news just out this morning. General Motors is selling the brand. Tentative deal has been widely expected as part of GM's restructuring. It could save thousands of American jobs. President Obama is on his way to the Middle East this evening, visiting Saudi Arabia and Egypt to meet with leaders and give a major speech. He'll talk about the American relations with the Muslim world and the Mideast peace process. He tells our partners at the BBC that he's trying to be optimistic.
Always have a lot of work. Yeah, I mean, nobody thought this was going to be easy. If it was easy, it would have been done. But I do think that we're going to be able to get serious negotiations back on track.
On the way back home, the president will stop in Europe to meet leaders, visit American troops, and mark the D-Day anniversary. Femi, okay, what else is in the headlines this
morning? Hello there, good morning all. The Senate is full of high-profile visitors today. Top of the list is Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Senators will vote on whether Judge Sotomayor becomes Justice Sotomayor. She will visit top Democrats and Republicans. The administration wants to get Sotomayor confirmed before the Senate's August break. Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal is also on the Hill today, testifying in confirmation hearings. He's slated to take over command of all U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And like Sotomayor, he also needs Senate confirmation. Now, he's not likely to face any serious opposition. Interesting news coming out of North Korea this morning. South Korean media report that Kim Jong-il has named his youngest son, Kim Jong-un, as the next leader of the isolated country. There's some speculation about who could lead the country next, and it's hot right now amid questions about Kim Jong-il's ill health.
And reports of more missile tests possibly going on in North Korea. The S&P and the Dow start trading this morning after a big rally yesterday. Futures suggest a flat opening this morning. We're talking later to Alain de Botton, author of the book The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, and we want to know how important is work to you. In the book, Alain says that life consists of love plus work. Do you believe that? Give us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Ever moved for love or taken a job for love? Tell us your story.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Huckenberry here. Later on in the program, I suppose you all are getting ready for work, those of you who aren't unemployed in this complex economy. But later on in the program, Alain de Botton is going to join us. He's a philosopher, a fabulous writer, and he's written a book called The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. And in it is this quote, and I want you to think about it for the next hour. He wanted to write a hymn to the intelligence, peculiarity, beauty, and horror of the modern workplace, and not least its extraordinary claim, the workplace that is, to being able to provide us alongside love with the principal source of life's meaning. Do you buy that? I alluded to it a moment ago. Do you buy that? Is love and work the principal source of life's meaning? If you think so, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Agree or disagree? We welcome all stories at thetakeaway.org. 8778-MyTech. Well, the workplace at General Motors changed a little bit yesterday, and Barack Obama posed this question to all of us as taxpayers. We basically own General Motors. Is it possible to own more than half of something and not be directly involved with how it's managed? The president says, sure.
In short, our goal is to get GM back on its feet, take a hands-off approach, and get out quickly.
Well, the workplace of General Motors includes large swashes of Washington as of this morning. Joining us now is David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times and author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. I guess we wouldn't call the acquisition of GM part of the inheritance. He actually went out and bought this, David. Good morning.
Well, you know, John, you could say that he certainly inherited the problem and he's trying to buy his way out of it. So you've got all these people in Washington these days who are waking up running GM and basically screaming, as the president himself did yesterday, that's okay. We really don't want to own it.
Well, let's talk for a minute. The challenge for me in the 8 minutes and 30 seconds that we have is to have a coherent conversation about two things that struck me yesterday, and you've written about them this morning in the paper. One is how in the federal environment that we've known for, you know, a century now, where the federal government is essentially a regulator, not an owner, but it does create rules for industrial companies, even though it doesn't actually own them. How is the federal government to regulate the auto industry on things like emission standards, even workplace questions, if it owns General Motors and doesn't own, say, Ford? What's the situation there? It seems to me a head-scratcher.
It sure does. And, you know, the situation that you described is only, to my mind, the beginning of the problem. Because let's say for a moment that somehow President Obama is able to pull this off, that he is able to enact the principles that this study I wrote about this morning that was done by some of his aides about the rules of the road for being a government shareholder actually get put in place. And what are the rules? The rules are no day-to-day management, be very activist at the beginning, appoint a board of directors and, you know, all that you need along those lines, but do not run the place with decisions being made at the White House about, as one of the president's aides put it to me, you know, no decisions about where to put car plants and no decisions about what color to make the cars. Okay, and the last big principle that they set was that they would, of course, get out quickly. So, how do you do that when the rest of the world looks at this and says, "Oh yeah, we've seen this before"? It's, you know, the French owning a big part of Peugeot or, you know, any other nationalized car maker. So if our rules make it difficult for some reason for, say, the Chinese to bring cars into the United States, isn't the rest of the world going to say, oh, sure, you're just protecting your state-owned car maker?
Well, there's a World Trade Organization to deal with that. I guess I'm more concerned with Alan Mulally at Ford, who wakes up this morning and says, the World Trade Organization isn't going to protect me. I'm stuck here. GM's favored. I'm on the one who's on my own.
Well, the argument on the other side of that, and I'm not saying I agree with this, I'll just tell you how it's been answered to me when I've asked the question, is that Ford was given an opportunity to receive government help and concluded that it didn't want it, and it didn't want the restrictions that go with it, and so that they made a choice. But certainly, if, you know, 3 years from now, Ford looks in tougher shape than GM, then that could be a problem. Now, I'm not certain that that's a realistic issue, because GM's got a long way to go. I mean, here they are getting rid of four of their eight lines, right?
Right.
Pontiac's going to go away. The Hummer's going to go. I don't know where you're going to fix your Hummer, John, but
yeah,
but you're going to have to find another place, right?
I know. It's terrible. I tried to do it myself. It's rough.
You know, so you're going to have these go away. And GM has got a lot more ground to make up in the area of building small cars that are, you know, highly efficient. And this is the place where I think the conflict between ownership and government objectives could be the greatest. The president's already stepped out and said, we're going to make small, fuel-efficient, low-carbon footprint cars and make them in the United States. Well, supposing the company comes back and says, you know, Mr. President, our most profitable cars are those big gas guzzlers like Hockenberry drives, you know, and we might need a good mix of those if we're going to get back to profitability.
Well, if for instance, the models do change, and I'll ignore the gas guzzler reference for just a moment, since I do own a Toyota, but and an Audi, actually, come to think of it. You know, can Ford make the claim that General Motors is being favored here in some sense, that that the environment for product development for GM is easier than it is for Ford, and actually sue the government on that basis?
I'm not sure what the suit would be because, as I said, Ford was offered the same deal, considered the options, and decided not to do it.
All right. Well, that presumably would be the basis for regulators saying, look, you had your chance. You're out in the cold. You know, good luck to you. We've got bigger fish to fry here with General Motors. Let me talk to you about another conflict, which I'm wondering about. It may be completely the result of my paranoid fantasies. But is it possible because the government owns AIG as well as General Motors now, that it's in a conflict of interest situation because, in theory, it holds both the fate of the debt held by GM creditors, right? I mean,
some of it.
Uh-huh. But it also holds the insurance policies that some of those debtors bought on, say, General Motors bonds, for instance, that AIG may have these weird credit default swap insurance policies of. So it's possible that the government is obligated to both give, say, 10 cents on the dollar to a bondholder for GM, but also pay out their insurance policy at 90 cents on the dollar, and we're on the hook for all that. Is that possible, and does that make any sense to you?
I guess it's possible, but it seems somewhat remote because most of the credit default swaps that we are aware of, and I could well be missing something here, were not in the territory of the GM bonds. But it's, you know, it's an interesting question to ask, but I've not seen any evidence yet that that's a problem. The much bigger problem with AIG and with GM, I think, is the problem of exit strategy. And at what point do you get to the point where either one of these companies is stable enough that you can actually sell it back into the private market? And I think President Obama is very sincere when he says he does want to get rid of them. But think about the tension here, John. We could sell the GM shares as a government back to private investors next year, which they say they want to do. They say they want to get rid of it in 2010. But if you sell too early, you're not going to get back the full investment that taxpayers have put into it, which right now is $50 billion,
right,
with a B, and climbing, right?
Sure.
If you wait a while and the company actually does get on its feet and they actually do start building cars that people want to buy and that are profitable, and the car market comes back, and the key bet here is how quickly you get back to a good-sized car market, then you might actually get that money back.
So,
but doing
so,
that means holding on longer.
So the longer you hold on, the bigger the regulatory headaches and the legal problems that we were talking about, the quicker you sell, the less money you make, and the more you just take a financial bath with the taxpayers' money.
And a little bit of the Iraq problem, which is you pull out too quickly, you don't know what chaos will ensue.
And if GM goes down, that's a political liability for Barack Obama headed straight into the off-year election. Okay, that makes total sense to me. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times, author of The Inheritance, The World Obama Confronts and the Challenges to American Power. And I did not know this, David runs a support group for men who own Hummers down in the Washington, D.C. area. David, thanks so much for being on the program.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
The Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Maybe we've all done it. Moved for love or ditched a relationship for a job. Love and work. They constitute the meaning of life, according to Alain de Botton, author of the book The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. We're going to talk to him a little later. We want to know which is more important to you, work or love. Steve writes to us on our website, love and work. We can have both if we are lucky, though maybe not in that order. So we're asking you, when have you had to choose? There's a story there. Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Meanwhile, in the skies over the Atlantic, we learned yesterday, somewhere between Africa and South America, tragedy.
We are facing a very dramatic event, an accident, a tragic accident. The chances of finding survivors at this point is very little.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy talking about what happened to the Air France flight, an Airbus 330 that vanished in a towering thunderstorm. No words from the pilot that they were in crisis. The plane beamed out several automated reports that its electrical systems had malfunctioned. And according to one report, it perhaps lost cabin pressure. The signals were sent not as distress calls and were not read for hours until air traffic controllers realized that the plane's crew had not radioed in on schedule. Putting together the pieces of what is apparently a tragedy with the loss of 228 lives at least is the work of air traffic investigators who are now trying even to find where the plane went down. Joining us now is Graham Warwick, senior technology editor for Aviation Week. He's in Washington, D.C. Graham, first on the minds, I think, of people who even heard sketchy reports yesterday is the idea that this plane was in some kind of storm, may have been struck by lightning, and there was an electrical failure. You know this plane. You know the electronics on the plane. What does an electrical failure mean, and could it have been caused by lightning?
Well, most of the things on an airplane these days are either powered or controlled electrically, so it's a pretty important part of the airplane. But because it's a pretty important part of the airplane, there are many, many levels of redundancy to prevent a total loss of power. So it's quite an unusual, almost unthinkable situation to actually totally lose power.
Now, oddly, last week we totally lost power in this studio, and shockingly, you know, we couldn't go on the air for like an hour and a half. But on a plane, what happens? If lightning takes out some sort of electrical system, there's a battery backup, and you've got a limited amount of time, what conceivably would the pilots be going through in the cockpit? Would they be flying blind? Would they be attempting to get the engines restarted? What sorts of things would be going on?
Well, to begin with, it's quite hard to work out how a lightning strike could cause a total electrical failure. The two different things. But if you were to assume that there was an electrical failure of some sort, the main power comes from the engines. There's two engines. Each of those engines has two generators generating power. If you lose the engines and lose those generators, there is an auxiliary power unit in the tail that can be started and has a generator on it. Now, there's a gap there while you start up the APU if it's not already running and get that going. That gap is bridged with batteries, which can drive the essential systems until the APU is up and running. If you have a problem with the APU, the last ditch, as they call it, is a small propeller that drops out the belly of the airplane and drives the hydraulic pump. And then on the hydraulic system is an electrical generator that will then power the system. So you may see some interruption of the displays. I mean, they may flicker, they may go out and then come back again. It's a fly-by-wire airplane, which means that the pilots' control inputs go through a computer before they get to the control surfaces. But they are separately have their own backup batteries and separate power sources. So there's usually, you know, it's when they certificate these airplanes, they look for, you know, minuscule possibilities and try to design those out. So, to interrupt the power to the fly-by-wire system is incredibly rare. To have some sort of interruption to the display system as the power systems are switching over is possible.
And
what would the pilot do? I mean, most of it is handled automatically. He'd see things coming up on his display saying, generator out, switching to back. You know, a lot of it is handled automatically. The checklists for things he has to go through come up on the displays, and he follows through the checklist. So usually you'd have time to work your way through a fault tree of things to do before something became catastrophic.
And this was at cruising altitude, so we're talking, 30,000, 39,000 feet even. Presumably there's a lot of time there before you would hit the ground. What would they be looking at as a kind of a catastrophic failure that would cause a crash from cruising altitude, which is pretty rare?
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons. This is why people are so surprised by this. It was a relatively new airplane, a reputable airline, an experienced crew, all of whom would know what to do if it was a conceivable accident. I mean, most airlines have become so safe that when you get accidents these days, they tend to be unique combinations of events, chains of events that lead to a catastrophic failure. So we're looking at this, and all of us are thinking that it's not one thing. Aircraft are designed to survive lightning strikes. Aircraft are designed to survive severe turbulence. Aircraft are designed to survive electrical failures. The only thing that we can think of looking at this with a total lack of information other than that last message from the airplane is that there was a chain of catastrophic failures that gave the crew no time whatsoever to either realize they had a problem, or realizing they had a problem, they had no time to alert or respond to whatever the problem was.
Well, a tragedy, and putting the chain of events together, if indeed that's what it is going to require the flight and data recorders from that aircraft, and they may never be found. So far, there isn't even a location where the plane went into the water. Thanks to Graham Warwick. My guest is Senior Technology Editor for Aviation Week. Graham Warwick joined us from Washington, D.C. And Femi Okay is here with the headlines right in the studio.
Thank you very much. The time is 28 minutes past the hour. In international news, the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is trying to make diplomatic headway in Latin America. Washington hasn't always had a warm relationship with the region. Clinton is stressing that the U.S. is ready for a new approach. Now, yesterday, she was in El Salvador for the inauguration of the country's first leftist president. Today, she's in Honduras, where she'll attend a top-level meeting of the Organization of American States. The group may vote on whether to reverse a nearly 50-year-old suspension of Cuba from membership. There's some new information this morning on the suspect in the shooting of a Kansas abortion doctor, George Tiller. Police say that Scott Roeder apparently acted alone. His ex-wife says that Roeder had strong anti-government and anti-abortion views. General Motors says that it has tentatively agreed to sell its Hummer brand. The move comes one day after the automaker filed for bankruptcy protection. GM is trying to transform the most successful parts of its business into a new company in just 30 days. And GM didn't say who bought the brand or at what price, but the company says that the sale will save thousands of jobs. GM and other automakers will report May auto sales later today. And that's a look at your news headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up, a conversation with Alain de Botton, author of the book The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. Work is a big part of life. Which is more important to you, work or that other big part of life, love?
They are intertwined. You have to have one with the other, and you do have one with the other, especially in my profession. I'm a teacher, and that's what I get every day, and that's what I give every day.
What if you had to choose between work and love, the two big components of the meaning of life? Tell us your take at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. And I was thinking today, in my short lifetime, The Tonight Show has gone from Steve Allen to Jack Parr to Johnny Carson to Jay Leno and now to Conan.
Yeah, that's nice. Please. It's coming across as angry now, all right? At least we know the applause sign works. That's nice.
The applause sign definitely worked for Conan O'Brien as he inaugurated his stint as Tonight Show host. Joining us to talk about the inauguration of not only Conan O'Brien in the Tonight Show seat out in Los Angeles, but also the summer TV season, which is a new phenomenon. We're going to talk about that in a moment. Is Angel Cohn, senior editor at the website Television Without Pity and Bravo Media, which is a division of NBC Universal, which also owns the Tonight Show. Good morning, Angel. How
good
are you
morning.
Doing?
Good morning.
First of all, you know, the hype, but of course there's always
right.
hype.
Always. I mean, every time there's a big transition
exactly,
like this.
The idea that Conan O'Brien somehow isn't going to translate is, of course, absurd.
He'll be fine. He's had a show for, you know, more than a decade now. I think he's proven himself.
You watched the show last night.
What did you think? He seemed a little bit nervous. The big stage, I think, overwhelmed him. But I think he's fine. I think he had a good time, and he, you know, was himself. He didn't try and be Jay Leno or be Johnny Carson. Like he was Conan.
Now, when Leno took over, Letterman was ahead for a while, and then gradually took over. Do you expect that to transpire here?
I'm not really sure. I think Conan has his legion of fans. I think it might take a little while for the Tonight Show audience to warm up to someone sort of a little edgier, maybe, than Jay Leno.
And it's an older audience, 11:30, and you know Letterman has the edgy group at 11:30. So we shall see. But the summer television season is actually a legitimate, real thing that
it
happens
is.
Now.
It's first all, of all, not all just reruns.
Exactly. When did that start, and where are the places that develop the creative shows for summer television versus what the networks do in the fall?
Right. A lot of the smaller cable networks, the HBOs, the Showtimes, TNT, TBS, seem to be sort of the home for scripted shows during the summer. The networks have taken this to be, let's just put on a lot of reality shows. So
summer has always been a dumping ground for the networks, but it's not for cable. Let's talk about Showtime's new show called Nurse Jackie,
right?
First of all, the premise, and then I'll play a couple of incidents of the show that we have here, and we can talk about it a little bit.
Okay. The premise simply is Edie Falco. She's a nurse. She's addicted to painkillers. She's sort of a fun, dark.
Fun, dark lady.
Yeah.
This is an example, I think, of fun, but you can hear the darkness here. Listen to this.
Is this happening? Not happening? I can't even tell.
Oh crap. I'm so sorry. Oh, God. No. When I get nervous, I act out with an inappropriate sexual touch. It's like Tourette's.
It's over. Okay, it happened, and now it's over, so there's that.
Not exactly an affair, not exactly a love story.
No.
But,
I mean, she is, in the first episode, we learned that she's sleeping with the pharmacist in order to get her pain meds for her back, so.
And she has her own drug problems.
Yes, she does. No. She does. She's not a little rosy ER nurse that you see on sort of the more mainstream medical dramas.
But she still has that impulse to, at all costs, save her own patients.
I tell you to order a scan, you order a goddamn scan. Because if you don't do it, I'll just go to the next doctor and the next doctor after that. In the meantime, that kid died. And it is all on you.
You know, medical shows have been around television for a long, long time. Right. And there's always the kind of, you know, soliloquy. Right. I'm going to do it. I don't care what the rules are.
Right.
This embodies a lot of that tradition of medical shows and a lot of wacky, weird stuff.
Yeah, this is definitely not your Chicago Hope sort of show. This is or Grey's Anatomy. This
Chicago
is
Dope, maybe.
Yeah. This is definitely sort of a character study of this one particular nurse and the sort of edgy environment that she works in.
Is it a spinoff of House, do you think?
No, not so much House. Even a little darker, because they can get away with a little bit more on Showtime.
Right. And you liked it?
I did. I saw the first episode, and I'm sort of hooked. I'm very excited to see more.
Now, this HBO offering for the summer, True Blood, right?
Yes, it's the second season.
Which began in this viral marketing campaign that actually a friend of mine was responsible for, which was really extraordinary, and it was a successful show.
Right.
What are they doing for a follow-up?
It's hard. It's based on a series of books by Charlene Harris, and it's going to be hard to sort of top it, but it's a vampire show, but it's not you know, the Twilight kind of series. It's definitely a
little more raunchy.
A little more raunchy, a little more grown up, and definitely a look at sort of like how vampires are treated. It's like equal rights in the human vampire world.
So there are a lot of strong women shows. Go down the list, and you're going to do some more elaborate blogging on all of these on our website, right? So go down the list. And then I want to ask you the question about the workplace.
Sure. The Closer with Kara Sedgwick, Saving Grace with Holly Hunter,
right.
Weeds with Mary Louise Parker, and there's a new other nurse show with Jada Pinkett Smith called Hawthorne that's starting that I'm not quite sold on yet, but it's there.
So the theme of the summer on TV is strong women, fun, dark.
Strong women, dark shows on cable networks, and really, really terrible reality on networks.
Angel Cohn, which do you think is more important for the meaning of life, love or work?
I've always been lucky enough to have both. I haven't had to make that tough decision. I did make a big move for love, but have been lucky enough to find a balance.
And now she loves being senior editor of the website Television Without Pity, Angel Cohn, talking about the summer television season. And Femi Oke is here with the headlines.
It's almost 21 minutes to the top of the hour. Brazilian media are reporting that search planes may have spotted debris off the missing Air France flight. Brazil's Air Force isn't confirming this yet. Officials lost contact with the Rio to Paris flight after it reported severe electrical problems. 228 people were on board. All of them, including two Americans, are now feared dead. Bad weather in the region is making searching harder. President Obama starts a six-day Middle East trip today in an outreach to the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. He will visit four countries, including Egypt, where President Hosni Mubarak has been in power for 30 years. And President Obama spoke to our partners, the BBC, yesterday. He was asked whether Mubarak was an autocrat.
He has been a stalwart ally in many respects to the United States. He has sustained peace with Israel, which is a very difficult thing to do in that region. So I think he has been a force for stability and good in the region.
Now, before heading to Egypt, the president will meet with King Abdullah in Saudi Arabia. The Defense Secretary Robert Gates isn't ruling out more spending on missile defense. That's if North Korea or other countries increase threats against the U.S. Gates says that his $1 billion requests for missile interceptors in the 2010 fiscal budget are adequate for now, but he says it's not a forever decision. That's a look at your news making headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. General Motors is owned by the American taxpayer. 60% of it anyway is, as General Motors declares bankruptcy yesterday. But what about all those workers and people around the country at the many, many plants that are awaiting their fate?
We recognize those sacrifices. Not only do we recognize them, we thank them for them, and we apologize for them at the same time.
That's Fritz Henderson talking yesterday at a news conference announcing the details of the GM bankruptcy. Some 550 people in Wilmington, Delaware, are among those that Henderson was apologizing to, apparently, as the General Motors plant in that community is set to close in July and those jobs will be lost. The community of Wilmington is sort of tied around the Interstate 95 corridor. It's full of all kinds of businesses that surround industrial plants of one kind or another. Andrew Eder joins us. He's a business reporter for the News Journal in Wilmington. I have to say, I've been through Wilmington many, many times, and I have a palpable visual sense of exactly the impact this is going to have in the community. How are you feeling this morning, Andrew?
Oh, fine, thanks. Appreciate you having me on. It's a huge blow for the state. No doubt.
And in this particular community, I mean, you really see in Wilmington, unlike some other places where the plants are kind of isolated from the rest of the community, all of the ancillary businesses that are around the plant, you can see places where people would stop after work or maybe before work. What are people saying about the ripple effect in the Wilmington area?
Well, that's really exactly where it's going to come. It's going to come from the spending of these auto workers in the state and the shops and the restaurants around the plant. In Delaware, it's not as much the supply base like it is in the Midwest, but it's really the ripple effects of these workers as their spending kind of moves through the economy.
And did, first of all, what was made at the GM plant there? And you also have a Chrysler plant that recently was furloughed. What were the products?
At the GM plant, they build the Pontiac Solstice and the Saturn Sky. And these are two-seater rear-wheel drive sports cars that people just aren't buying today amid the recession. And at the Chrysler plant, which was closed in December, they build the built the Dodge Durango and Chrysler Aspen, which are large SUVs that also had the bad luck of falling out of favor with consumers.
Well, let's talk about the Pontiac Solstice for a moment. I mean, that was supposedly General Motors' indication that it would never abandon Pontiac. It must be a real heartbreaker.
It certainly is, and it was kind of, I mean, when the car debuted in 2005, it was a rock star. It was on Donald Trump's show, The Apprentice, and sold out minutes after that show ended, and they added a third shift back in 2006 to keep up with demand for the car. But it's just a case of, you know, amid this recession, people are not buying those very discretionary purchases like that.
How do you think people in Wilmington are likely to take Fritz Henderson's apology and thank you for all the sacrifices?
I think there's some sense of resignation here with the closing of the Chrysler plant in December. The writing was really on the wall.
Right.
And these plants both, for years, had lived with kind of the constant threat of closure.
Well,
there's certainly a lot of anger among the auto workers at the company.
And closure as of today. I mean, the plant doesn't close down as of today, but they certainly have closure. Their fate is clear. Andrew Eder, business reporter for the News Journal in Wilmington, Delaware, where a GM plant will close after the bankruptcy.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. What we do for work or love and why. Coming up, but first, headlines with Femi Okeh.
Thank you very much, John. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Getting some reports from Brazil's Air Force that they are actually seeing debris of what looks like the plane wreckage from the Air France plane that Air France lost contact with yesterday. The wreckage seems to be around about 375 miles off the coastline of Brazil. So I will bring you some more details on that when and if I get them. There were 228 people on board that flight. Now, all of them, including two Americans, are feared dead. Back in the United States, the Senate is back to work and it's got a high-profile visitor today. The Supreme Court nominee, Sonia Sotomayor, will meet with top lawmakers. It's something of a tradition for high court nominees. She will visit top Senate Democrat Harry Reid and then she'll also meet with his Republican counterpart, Mitch McConnell. Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal is also visiting the Senate to testify today. He's slated to take over command of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And like Sotomayor, he also needs Senate confirmation. He's not likely to face serious opposition. And finally, General Motors has sold off one of its high-profile brands.
It's a Hummer, a vehicle that defies comparison or categorization. A vehicle not in a class, but a universe all its own. A wolf in a field of sheep.
Hummer? Bummer.
Yes.
Bummer about Hummer.
Yeah, well, GM, who's now in bankruptcy, has said that it's tentatively agreed to make the sale of its Hummer brand. It could save up to 3,000 jobs. And so that's a look at some of the top stories making headlines this morning, John.
Loving your work, Femi?
Thank you.
Loving your work? You are?
Oh, are you?
Are you
loving
your
thought
work?
You said that you were loving my work.
Yeah. Well, I'm, of course,
yes,
loving your work.
I love my work.
Yeah.
Too much, in fact.
Glad to hear it. You mean you don't have enough of a life?
I just, it's my passion.
So maybe you don't have the balance between
work. I have no balance. I'm not known for my balance.
Well, I'm sure all of you out there are thinking about work this morning right now. Where do you get life's meaning? Is it from work? Is it like Femi, work kind of drags you out of your life a little bit into something it's hard to write a poem or a hymn about or something like that? You'll be delighted with our next guest, though. Alain de Botton is the author of the new book, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work. He joins us from Bush House in London at the studios of our partner, the BBC. Alain, first of all, good morning, and thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
I mean, I have to say, maybe sometimes I gush on this show, but this book is a really spectacular beauty of a book. And I'm wondering if the fact that you don't have to work gives you such a sense of poetry about the job so many of the rest of us must do to survive.
I think the interesting thing is that everybody has to work. You know, you can be a best-selling writer and you could retire, but the point is everybody needs to work because it's right at the core of who we are as modern human beings. You can't get through a conversation with anybody without the person saying to you, what do you do? And they're not just asking
exactly.
you, as it were, for a piece of information. They're asking you for your soul. They're asking you, what keeps you going? What kind of a human being are you? Not to have an answer to that is really terrible. That's what makes unemployment so tragic. It's not just the money. It's the denial of, you know, your sheer existence.
And, you know, what this book does, I think, aside from being a piece of art just sort of all by itself, I mean, it answers a question we try to answer every single morning on this program. What is the sort of human dimension, the human narrative behind all of these economic numbers that we talk about every day? This book seems to be a hybrid of books like Working that Studs Terkel did, where people talk about their own jobs in their own words. It's also a kind of a John McPhee sort of book, a portrait of huge pilots of giant ships and things. In your own words, where did you go to get these stories, and why weren't people as candid with you as I thought they might be?
I love, by the way, how you position the book. These are absolutely the two heroes that were kind of guiding the book. What I wanted to do was to give a picture of the modern working economy. We hear words like globalization, etc., but we often don't know what that really means. So I wanted to make a book that would look at 10 very different, deliberately eclectic professions. I've got everything there from transmission engineering to accountancy to rocket science to people who make cookies, a whole range of things. And threaded through these explorations of particular workplaces are large questions like, what are we doing this for? Where's this headed? And also a very subtle thing that keeps coming up is, how does this deliver happiness? And if it doesn't, how can we inch a little bit closer to what we all want from our work, which is that we don't notice it is work, as you hinted before?
Well, the ship captains you talk to in the container ports and these giant warehouses that work at night and ship everything that we use every day from here to there around the world, it seemed easy for you to develop a sense of reverence about that work. Why? And then I want to talk about one of the more challenging professions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a lot about the working world which is deeply impressive. It's where a huge number of people put their collective energies. You know, it's very easy to hate people when you see them on a vacation looking slightly red-faced and overweight. Perhaps I'm just talking about myself here. But it's, you know, when you see people doing their work, they're doing it halfway decently, it's very moving. Because what you're seeing is human intelligence at work on a task. And that's great to see. And when you go and see, you know, vast factories, huge turbines, the big pieces of equipment of the modern world, there's something just inherently moving. It's the kind of human sublime, and that's terrific.
Was there a piece of equipment you fell in love with?
Well, I went down to South America, to French Guiana, a very strange place where the Europeans have got their space agency where they launch rockets. And I must say, you know, it's a very kind of boy's own thing to like, but you know, seeing one of these Ariane rockets soaring off into the sky, you think, you know, gee, on a good day, human beings are very impressive creatures indeed.
Now, that was the venture to produce Wow Wow TV in Japan to compete with NHK. They needed to launch a satellite, and they all went down there to watch the launch. That was their job. Did you envy them?
I did envy them, you know, because they're part of a giant collective project. Science and technology moves in teams nowadays. We've got this idea that, you know, scientific geniuses are always sitting there in their garages coming up with amazing things. But really, science and technology is a collective thing. And there's something beautiful, again, about seeing a vast team of people. Each team is maybe attacking a tiny part of some puzzle in, say, satellite electrics. They might spend 25 years working out how to, you know, reduce frequency interference above 25 gigahertz. So I'm absolutely trying to think that might be their life's work. And it's a kind of devotion that, again, you can't help but find rather moving.
And yet, how do you make reverence, or how do you generate reverence for a meeting about the irritating delay in the completion of the non-audit services annual independence continuance form for annuity engagements, which the accountants you profiled were actually engaged in?
That's absolutely. Well, I went to hang out with accountants partly because accountancy is the quintessential boring job. And I thought I was challenged by this, and I thought it can't be that boring. I mean, really what it is incredibly detailed. We live in a world of such complexity that you do get these professions like accountancy where practitioners will devote their life to a question that seems so arcane. You know, you couldn't ask a person at a party what they did and hope to understand. This takes weeks to understand what on earth they are doing. And it does lead, on a bad day, to a feeling of disconnection, to a feeling that what is the meaning of this work? Because one of the things I think we're all desperate for in our work is meaning. What is meaning? I think meaning comes when you feel that through your work, you've made an improvement to somebody's life or you've reduced their suffering.
And you found it there.
Well, an accountant who sorts out somebody's tax problem is doing that.
Yeah, well, I've smiled when my accountant has given me good news. Finally, you describe processes and industrial mechanisms that are on a huge global scale. In the midst of all that, did you find the human being at the center of it?
Yes, because at the end of the day, it's always the individual worker. And, you know, we haven't changed what we want from our work. We want from our work nowadays what we've always wanted, which is a sense of connection to other human beings, a sense of helping them, a sense of imposing order on a chaotic world. That's what we love work for. It distracts us from terrible things like the fact we're all going to die. It keeps us focused. And as I say, on a good day, we manage to make something which is that little bit better than we manage to be in our private lives, in the rest of our lives.
A distraction from mortality. That's great advice. Alain de Botton, author of the new book, The Pleasures and Sorrows of Work, thanks so much for joining us. And we've already received some feedback on the interview.
That book by Alain de Botton sounds like a real fairy tale. It just sounds like he's trying to make an American mythological fairy tale. Did he talk to anyone that has to work in a sweatshop? There's no bargaining power for minimum wage, if that. Did he talk to anyone who has to work in a department store or Walmart? Please, let's get real here. Let's talk about real work.
He did go into the accountant's office. It was not very glamorous, and there was some misery there, and he observed some workplaces not as glamorous like the United Biscuits Factory in eastern Belgium. But we love criticism on this show. We also were asking everyone all morning, which is more important to you, work or what you do for love?
As a head of household, I work to provide for those I love, my family. What I love to do is independent of employment. I would love to combine the two.
Maybe we should get him back on the phone and figure out how he's going to do that. That could be at least a couple of segments on the program. Have you ever had to choose between the two? Have you moved for love, or have you split up a relationship because of a job? Ever based major life decisions around your career? Tell us the story, because there's a story there at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Don't think too long about it now. Don't depress yourself. Just call us, 877-8-MY-TAKE. We'll help you out. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Abortion doctor George Tiller is killed. What happens to his patients?
I had one yesterday who was canceled from Tiller, and I tried to tell her, well, she needs to go to New York, or she needs to go to Boulder, Colorado, because it's not getting done anywhere close, and all she could do was cry, and I couldn't do anything to help her.
Some women running out of options as a doctor's murder puts women's health clinics on alert. The private agonies of public health in the wake of an assassination in a doctor's church. Doctors in harm's way on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, everyone. Tuesday, June 2nd, we will have a conversation with some doctors very, very worried about the aftermath of the Tiller assassination. I'm John Hockenberry. Coming up this hour, we'll talk to a GM exec to get the latest on the company's resurrection. Bug bites are lousy, but when turtles get them, it teaches us about natural history. We'll light a citronella candle and explain what's going on in the Galapagos. All this and more ahead. First, your top headlines. And in the headlines, news that searchers may have found floating debris from the missing Air France flight. Brazil's Air Force says it spotted seats and other items floating along the plane's flight path, but it's not yet certain they're from the Rio to Paris flight that officials lost contact with. 228 people were on board. All of them, including two Americans, are feared dead. General Motors has a tentative deal to sell Hummer. Right now, GM is keeping the buyer of the bulky, gas-hungry SUV brand confidential as part of the agreement. GM says the sale could save thousands of American jobs. A Middle East trip is on the agenda tonight for President Barack Obama, visiting Saudi Arabia and Egypt to meet with leaders and give a major speech. He'll talk about America's relations with the Muslim world and the Middle East peace process. The White House is pushing for Israel to stop building settlements and return to the negotiating table. He tells our partners at the BBC that Arab leaders need to do their part as well.
I think that we have not seen a set of potential gestures from other Arab states or from the Palestinians that might deal with some of Israeli concerns.
Again, the president leaves tonight for the Middle East. Femi, okay, what else is going on in the headlines this morning?
Hello there. The Senate is full of high-profile visitors today. Tops on the list is Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Senators will vote on whether Judge Sotomayor becomes Justice Sotomayor. She will visit top Democrats and Republicans. Lieutenant General Stanley McChrystal is also on the Hill today, testifying in confirmation hearings. He is slated to take over command of all U.S. forces in Afghanistan. And like Sotomayor, he also needs Senate confirmation. He's not likely to face serious opposition. There's some interesting news coming out of North Korea this morning. South Korea media report that Kim Jong-il has named his youngest son as his successor. Now, not much is known about his youngest son, although intelligence officials say that he's in his mid-20s. And we're also getting news from South Korean media that Pyongyang is getting ready for some more missile tests.
After a rampage north yesterday, the S&P and the Dow both grew more than 2.5% yesterday. The Dow and S&P start trading above their normal highs. 942 is the S&P beginning. 8721 is the number for the Dow. A flat opening expected on Wall Street. What's more important in your life? We've been talking about it all morning. Love or work? How do you balance the two? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. Well, it's not a surprise exactly, but very recently it was unthinkable. General Motors is now in bankruptcy, and Fritz Henderson, the CEO of General Motors, has one thing on his agenda: to shrink fast.
With the support we have, we're quite confident. There's always risk, but we're confident that we will move fast. Not with a sense of urgency. I'm talking about pure unadulterated speed.
Pure unadulterated speed to become a smaller company that emerges from bankruptcy within 2 or 3 months and perhaps emerges from 60% ownership by the federal government, which was basically the number that Barack Obama said we all have as our stake in this company, General Motors, once the largest auto company in the world. Joining us now is a General Motors executive, GM North America Vice President for Vehicle Sales, Service, and Marketing. He's on the line from GM headquarters in Detroit, Michigan. Mark LaNave, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
A couple of things, Mark, a few details here. The ownership of GM appears to be in Washington, D.C. You're at the Renaissance Center there in Detroit. I understand that building may be sold and you're going to be moving up the river. Are your offices moving?
I believe that Fritz addressed that, our CEO Fritz Henderson, yesterday, where he indicated our headquarters were going to remain here in Detroit. Will we continue to consolidate certain functions into some of our bigger facilities like our Warren Tech Center? Yeah, that'll probably continue. But I believe the core of the headquarters is certainly going to remain here and at the Renaissance Center, if not all the people that are here right now. And I believe Fritz confirmed that yesterday.
Well, there's a lot of turmoil, and I'm just wondering, are you confident about what your job actually is this morning? And if you could tell me, just give me a brief description.
Well, my job is actually, I'm in charge of our vehicle brands in North America. Used to be eight. Part of the restructuring is going to be our four core brands, Chevrolet, Cadillac, Buick, GMC. We are, you know, obviously phasing out the Pontiac brand, as we talked about, as part of this restructuring. Looking to sell Hummer, Saturn, and Saab. I don't know if you've picked it up, but we announced that we have reached an agreement on the sale of the Hummer brand, which is terrific news.
Right. What is the specific message to owners of Hummers who are headed out to their driveway right now to drive to work in terms of things like warranty and resale, that sort of thing?
Well, the message in terms of those things is the same for any GM owner. Your warranty is solid. It's your GM dealer's open for business. It's full, your warranty, if it need be, is fully backed by the U.S. government. The reason they're able to do that is that they don't have any doubt that GM is going to move into the future and be able to service our customers. Obviously, they're supporting us with financing and taking an equity position in the new company. And it's terrific news for Hummer owners as the brand will move on. It'll continue to evolve over time. It'll provide that great off-road experience, but most certainly with smaller, more fuel-efficient vehicles as we take advantage of battery technology and those things.
Right.
I think it means the resale value of your Hummer is probably got shored up overnight, and your Hummer dealer is going to be around for years to come to take care of the customer.
We shall see. Less of an optimistic message, those for Solstice owners. The Wilmington plant shuts down. That vehicle, the two-seater, which was supposed to be a sign that GM would never abandon Pontiac. Now, I guess I'd feel a little humble if I was driving a Solstice around this morning. You got a message for the Solstice driver of Pontiac?
The pain in the restructuring is absolutely felt, you know, by every stakeholder. And you know, the elimination of brands, you know, in the case of Pontiac, an historic, great performance brand, this is difficult stuff. I believe that the resale value of Pontiac, particularly a product like the Solstice, actually will probably increase with the fact that there will be, as it turns out, an historically low limited run.
Well, it's kind of a collector's item.
Exactly. Right. But, you know, it's difficult making these decisions, and we've had to restructure our capacity footprint to be smaller, more fuel efficient, our brand footprint, our salary and hourly headcount footprint, and our dealer footprint. And none of this is easy. That's the sobering piece of it. But we are very energized about the opportunity that we've been afforded here, and you know, we feel grateful for it. Not too many companies get it.
Mark,
reinvent the company and move forward and rebuild ourselves, and
gotcha.
That's really what we're focused on.
Mark, are you energized about hearing those numbers out of Fritz Henderson's mouth yesterday when he was asked by the reporter from China what the situation is in the Chinese business, and they talked about 30% growth over the next quarter? You're competing with the Chinese division over there. How do you feel about that?
Well, the success that we've had in China is an integral part of what will be the new General Motors. That's a self-contained business there. It funds itself. But, you know, our philosophy is to build where we sell. 98% of the vehicles that we sell in North America, we build in North America. We're committed to do that. We're going to build the new Chevy Volt here. Hopefully we'll create more jobs with battery technology and other fuel-efficient technologies in the future. We're going to build a small car in America. We're going to do it profitably. That's been announced. And, you know, we need to get the U.S. business. The China business has been profitable from day one. We need to get our Brazilian business is terrific. We need to get the U.S. business,
all right,
North American business profitable. And that's a big task right now with the market under 10 million units.
Well, but it seems like the task is harder given that 60% ownership is in Washington. Do you believe for a moment that the same government which suggested that bankruptcy by General Motors was unthinkable is really going to stay out of your business, particularly in North America?
John, I'm pretty confident.
Pretty confident.
We heard President Obama. Well, I'm confident because we need the market to, you know, and the economy to turn around. But in terms of the government involvement, I did a lot of the interface with the U.S. Treasury Task Force as they did due diligence on our business, and they weren't prescriptive in any way. These are very smart people. They were very positive in the way that they dealt with us. They were doing due diligence on behalf of the American taxpayer, which they had every right and actually an obligation to do. And they questioned every aspect of the business, but they didn't prescribe any specific actions in terms of brands, models, footprint, dealers, headcount levels.
Well, there's a lot of time for all of that over the next 3 months, Mark, right?
But I think President Obama made it pretty clear. They're not looking to run a car company. They will probably put, a strong board in place. They certainly will do that. That will hold us accountable, and they need to do that, and we need to be accountable. And and rebuild this business and repay the taxpayer. I'm sure the government and the other stakeholders like the VEBA Trust and the bondholders, they're going to want to monetize their equity position as quickly as they can, and it's our hope to build value so they can do that.
Mark, we'll let you get back to work. Mark LaNave is GM North America Vice President for Vehicle Sales Service and Marketing, energized and optimistic about the future. Thanks so much for joining us, Mark.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Micheline Maynard is here in the studio. We are delighted to have auto reporter for the New York Times, and you were at the news conference that Fritz Henderson attended yesterday. Are you as confident as Mark LaNave that the government is going to stay out of this business?
I'm not at all. In fact, if you think back just a couple weeks ago, we got new fuel economy standards from the Obama administration. President Obama has talked repeatedly since he was a U.S. senator about the need for hybrid electric cars, small cars, and I'm not sure if that message is getting through.
And Fritz Henderson addressed this directly. He suggested that Americans are still buying cars as though fuel prices are rising. Does that mean GM is behind the curve in developing more fuel-efficient cars?
I'm sure they wish they were farther ahead of the curve. You know, they'll tell you that they have more models of fuel-efficient cars than anybody else, but it's because they have more models than anybody else. And I think that you heard Mark LaNave just talk, and what I didn't hear was the customer. I heard we've got to do this and we've got to do that, but you've got to get people to buy your automobiles. That's the biggest challenge.
The frightening thing that was said by Fritz Henderson yesterday is that they can't do what they used to do in the past, where they'd try 10 brands and hope that, you know, they'd have 15 launches and maybe 5 or 6 would work. I mean, that's a preposterous business model, but they have to hit on every model this time.
Right, but it's the same challenge that everybody faces. Ford faces this, Honda faces this, Toyota faces this, and the big Detroit companies, GM and Chrysler, specifically have been able to get away with these huge families of vehicles. You can't do that anymore. You confuse customers. And if they don't get clarity, they'll go somewhere else.
There was some clarity from Fritz Henderson suggesting that the most profitable part of the business in North America was the sale of trucks. I gather that would be Chevy and GM from here on out. But he said it was only in North America. Nobody else in the world buys these trucks. What does that say to you?
Well, it says that they still look at things from a financial model rather than a product model. And everywhere else in the world, you have small to medium-sized cars, a few crossover vehicles, you know, those sort of small SUVs. You have a few minivans, and that's kind of it. That's the global car market, and we still are different. And I think the American market is pretty quickly moving towards the global model, and you have to lead that. You can't just be catching up in it.
Mark LaNave a moment ago said, in a 10 million unit environment, it's challenging to be profitable. What's that 10 million unit number that he's talking about
there?
Well,
about 5 years ago when the car market was booming, we sold 17 million cars a year. Right now, the selling rate, which is if you take, say, April car sales and transpose it over a year, is 9.32 million. So we're
that's
down.
That's everybody or just GM?
That's the whole market. So we're down 45% in about 5 years.
So this new company is going to have to chop up a pie that's down 40%, that's less than 10 million units, and Ford is increasing market share even as we speak.
Right. And in fact, there's something in what the president said, I think, the other day, that GM may shrink to as little as 13% of the car market, and they're about 19% now.
Do the math, 13% of 9 million. Well, we own it, as Colin Powell said about Iraq. Let's hope GM is not broken. 60% of the old GM. Micheline Maynard, auto reporter for the New York Times. Thanks so much for being here in the studio. Next time you come to New York, please stop by. Have a safe trip back to Detroit.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. We talk about the meaning of life. I'm John Hockenberry. I think about it all the time. But what about the meaning of work? Life consists of work and love and the time to enjoy it. We want to know which is more important to you, work or love. John from Dartmouth, Massachusetts, called early to say he loved his job. Of course, he forgot to say what he did, so he called back.
I am a political organizer up here for the last gubernatorial race, but the job I love so much right now is I'm deputy director of business development and construction reform for the Massachusetts Office of Minority and Women Business Assistance, and I absolutely love helping them develop and grow.
Tell us your thoughts at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's exactly what the book we were reading this morning was all about, finding reverence for even the most banal, fabulous details of your life. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Well, we were on Capitol Hill for much of the newscast, talking about Sonia Sotomayor going around and meeting all of the senators. Her confirmation hearing comes up sometime this summer, but are you aware of General Stanley McChrystal's confirmation hearing? When President Obama announced his nominee for the top American commander in Afghanistan a few weeks ago, he was heralded as the direction forward in the war-torn country. His confirmation hearings begin today, and some critics are urging senators to look closely at what this general did and didn't know about a facility called Camp Nama, which was operated by a task force under his command in Iraq. It's one of the details on his resume, and someone who is taking a critical eye to McChrystal is Spencer Ackerman, who writes for the Washington Independent. Spencer joins us from Washington. Thanks for being with us, Spencer.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
You know, we tend to think that one general's like another, and that, you know, if Gates and Obama want this general, well, the Senate will probably confirm this or that person. He's a special ops general, which is part of the motivation for hiring him, we were told, when Mr. McKiernan, General McKiernan, was fired from the Afghan theater. What should we be looking at for someone with this kind of a resume?
Well, first, about the Afghanistan war itself, given that the war is being prosecuted as a counterinsurgency campaign, which means that great care has to be placed to attending to the concerns of the population, we want to check out what General McChrystal says about viewing the conflict through the prism of seeking out an enemy to destroy, which is typically the focus of special operations forces, or viewing it as a problem to solve among the concerns of the population, meaning taking a look at their ability to secure themselves from an enemy or to have their political interests advanced, justice served, their economic and other developmental needs met. So that'll be one thing to look at. What some critics are pointing to, as you mentioned, is his role about what he did or didn't know about Camp Nama and other aspects of this task force, known sort of loosely as Task Force 626, that went hunting for, among other high-value terrorist targets in Iraq, the al-Qaeda in Iraq leader Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, and there's been documentation about abuse that members of that task force inflicted on Iraqi detainees.
Now, the counterinsurgency strategy championed by David Petraeus, the head now of CENTCOM, I believe, is all about both going after very specific enemies, but also, you know, winning the hearts and minds of the population. It sounds like McChrystal is better at going to get the enemies in dark places rather than winning the hearts and minds.
A caveat of that is that many in the counterinsurgency community, including Petraeus, who worked closely with McChrystal, believe that McChrystal is one of the great talents of his generation of Army officers, that he's one of the smartest, he's one of the most adaptable, and ultimately was a contributing player in the surge in Iraq, which reduced violence significantly. And so it's going to be a bit of a murky picture until McChrystal articulates for himself what he views the proper focus of the war to be. As a special operations commander, he's been necessarily secretive. He's not someone who's been in the public eye. But for close watchers of the Army, in particular in defense more general, he's been known as a rising star for quite some time.
Is he going to have more difficult with the culture of the traditional Army being a special ops guy, or more trouble with the tradition and culture of the Congress being forced to testify publicly on Capitol Hill? For instance, will the incident of Pat Tillman, the pro footballer who died by friendly fire in Afghanistan in 2004, is that going to come up?
It would be surprising if it didn't come up. Pat Tillman's family has expressed concern about McChrystal's nomination. One of the investigations into the events of Pat Tillman's tragic death noted that McChrystal pointed out that the Bush administration and the military more broadly should stop referring to Tillman's death as occurring from hostile forces, but it didn't recommend him for any administrative or legal action and basically acquitted him of wrongdoing. So it would be very surprising if no one at the panel today at the Senate addressed the Tillman issue or offered McChrystal an opportunity to clarify what his role was here and as well with Camp Nama.
Do you think in Washington this rising star, as you've said, this talent of his generation is being explicitly protected for future assignments and that deliberately the members of the Senate aren't going to look into any of these issues?
Well, I reported in a piece that's up now at the WashingtonIndependent.com that members of the Armed Services Committee staff have been talking with opponents of prisoner abuse, and so they've clearly been taking an interest in getting to the bottom of the McChrystal case, and so that'll probably come up. What was very significant, though, is that McChrystal's hearing is not going to be a hearing of just McChrystal. He's testifying alongside two other very senior military officers who are up for important jobs. And so that kind of raises an eyebrow about the degree to which senators will have sufficient time to address McChrystal and the Nama and the Tillman issues in open session.
And does it send the signal that he's being given some sort of procedural cover here in the Senate? There is no expected significant opposition to General McChrystal. Spencer Ackerman, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Spencer Ackerman, senior reporter for the Washington Independent, formerly of Talking Points Memo and The New Republic, talking about the nomination of General Stanley McChrystal to take over command in Afghanistan. Femi Okay has our headlines.
Just coming up to 29 minutes past the hour. Senators will get their first face-to-face meeting with Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor. Today, she's set to meet with 10 lawmakers ahead of her official hearings. The administration wants to get Sotomayor confirmed before the Senate's August break. General Motors says that it has tentatively agreed to sell its Hummer brand. The decision is just a day after GM filed for bankruptcy protection. The automaker is trying to trim down to a leaner company on the strength of its more successful assets. And GM didn't say who bought the brand or at what price. In international news, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton is trying to repair some past tension between the U.S. and Latin America. She's stressing that the Obama administration is ready to take a new approach towards the region. She's in Honduras today for a top-level meeting of the Organization of American States. Let's look at news making headlines this morning.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering auto insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry. To get to the meaning of your life, you have to figure out the meaning of your work, and then you throw love in there, and sometimes you have to choose which is more important to you. One listener called from Michigan, where her husband lost his job and is now looking out of state.
He's going somewhere else to work. A lot of families in the Midwest are faced with this dilemma, and a lot of professionals in the Midwest are learning that they are working-class people, that they do have to chase that paycheck, that we are no different than any other laborer in any industry.
Tell us your thoughts about what you will do for love or career at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. Simon Goodman, it must be great to be an evolutionary biologist there at the University of Leeds, am I right?
It is. I get to go to lots of nice places around the world.
Well, talk about the Galapagos. You have a paper that's published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences called Natural Colonization and Adaptation of a Mosquito Species in the Galapagos and its Implication for Disease Threats to Endemic Wildlife. It's all about mosquitoes evolving and threatening the turtles in the Galapagos.
Well, that's right. That's right. It's not just the tortoises in Galapagos. It's the disease threat to the whole Galapagos ecosystem that we're interested in. And so we've been working there together with Ecuadorian scientists since 2003 to try and understand what potential disease threats there could be to Galapagos. And we're interested in this because there's a large precedent of disease being a serious problem for biodiversity around the world. And species in isolated islands are particularly susceptible to imported diseases. So, for example, in Hawaii, the introduction of a mosquito called Culex quincafasciatus, avian malaria and avian pox has been implicated in several extinctions of endemic birds there.
I mean, part of the narrative here is that biologists are very worried that the Galapagos might end up like what happened in Hawaii, where the imposition of civilization really brought an enormous number of diseases and pests and species to the island and transformed the animal life there irrevocably, right?
That's right. So, and the same process is starting to happen in Galapagos. Although Galapagos is still relatively pristine compared to most other oceanic archipelagos around the world. But just to give a little bit of context to that, there are around about 560 native plant species in Galapagos, but there are now more than 700 introduced plant species. And there's sort of similar story for animals as well.
Well, the thing that fascinates me about this article is that, you know, one might assume, okay, suddenly there's a new threat to tortoises in the Galapagos. The implication in this kind of global warming environment that we've grown up with, where the headlines are, okay, there must be some sort of human intervention here. That was the original suspect. But what you discovered is, no, you've actually caught evolution in midstream, in a kind of a snapshot here. Explain what's going on. The threat is not from something foreign.
That's right. So what we've been doing is looking at one component of the Galapagos ecosystem to understand its role in the epidemiology of diseases there. And so we've been looking at one particular species of mosquito that's present in Galapagos, and this is a species called Aedes tenorhynchus.
And they usually, suck the blood of mammals, right?
That's right. So this is a species that's very widely distributed in the Americas. So it's found from the northern coast of Peru up to California on the Pacific coast, and it's found from northern Brazil up to New Jersey on the Atlantic coast. And there, this is a species which is found mainly in salt marshes and mangroves, and it's mainly a mammal-feeding mosquito, and it occasionally feeds on birds as well.
So the boring old mosquito that we're familiar with suddenly transplants itself to the Galapagos and finds itself isolated for how long?
Well, one of the things we wanted to find out was where it came from, how often it moves around the archipelago, and what it's feeding on. And there are two other species of mosquito in Galapagos, which have been introduced very recently by humans. So the one that we were focusing on, the Aedes tenorhynchus, the first reports of that were from about 1880. And so we kind of assumed that it was also a human introduction, which kind of occurred a little bit earlier. And so we used some genetic techniques to try and look at where it came from and when. And by comparing the genetics of the mosquito on Galapagos with those on the continent, we actually found a lot of genetic differences. And by kind of counting those up, we were able to estimate that it arrived in Galapagos about 200,000 years ago. So it's actually
wow.
A natural colonization.
So in that 200,000 years, the mosquito appears to have developed the skill to pierce not only mammalian skin, but reptilian skin, right?
That's right. So this is one of the other key things that we found by looking at what it was feeding on. So we were collecting mosquitoes and trapping them. And occasionally when we trap them, you find mosquitoes that have a blood meal. And then by also looking at the DNA of what's in that blood meal, you can work out what it's fed on. And we found that actually in Galapagos, it's mainly feeding on reptiles, so Galapagos giant tortoises and marine iguanas.
So suddenly, mosquitoes have developed the ability to attack reptiles, which was never the case. Turtles are getting mosquito bites, which means they're open to the possibility of infection by mosquitoes. And does this mosquito become a gateway to an entire world of diseases?
That's exactly right. So the issue now is that this mosquito is very widely distributed through the whole of the archipelago, and it's feeding on a broad range of species in Galapagos. So it also feeds less frequently on sea lions. And we've also found it to feed very rarely on birds. So it has the potential to interact with all those charismatic species in Galapagos.
So let's get a little sense of the time scale here before we go. The mosquito's been on the island for 200,000 years, right?
That's right, yes.
Evolutionary biologists estimate the tortoises have been there for how long?
Well, they've probably been there for much longer than that.
Millions and millions, right?
Maybe not quite millions, but several hundred thousand years more than the mosquito.
Is this a case, and you've published it in the 2009 Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, is this a case where evolution is working against us as far as biodiversity is concerned?
Well, it's not really per se. It's how that interacts with what's going on in the modern world. So the big concern here is that a disease-carrying mosquito could hitch a ride on a plane bringing tourists to Galapagos, and then the mosquitoes that are present in Galapagos could pick up that disease and then spread it throughout the whole of Galapagos into lots of the different species in Galapagos.
And because they can suddenly bite reptiles, the tortoises, normally invulnerable with their big shells, are actually threatened.
That's right, yes.
Well, Simon Goodman, a great detective story there. Thanks for telling it to us. Simon Goodman is an evolutionary biologist at the University of Leeds, where he talked to us from. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
At 21 minutes to the top of the hour, Brazil's air force is battling bad weather in its search to find clues from a missing Air France plane over the Atlantic. French military are also involved in the recovery effort. Here's the French military commander spokesman, Christophe Prazouk.
The weather is very bad, raining, and the visibility is poor. A civilian Brazilian pilot reported orange spots on the sea. And so this morning we have a new maritime patrol aircraft on the area trying to confirm this information.
So far, what it has been confirmed is that there has been debris spotted, airplane seats spotted as well, but no confirmation that this debris is from the missing Air France Airbus. Officials lost contact with the Rio to Paris flight after it reported severe electrical problems. 228 people were on board. And in the United States, top House and Senate Democrats reached a tentative deal on an almost $100 billion war funding bill. This happened yesterday. The bill also includes a generous line of credit for the International Monetary Fund. Let's look at top stories making headlines.
Thank you, Femi.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Some music about a cloud there. The name of that song by Ralph Towner is Nimbus. Nimbus, the storm cloud. Clouds have great names, don't you think? Cumulus, Stratus, Cirrus. Combinations like Stratocumulus. But cloud enthusiasts in the United Kingdom are petitioning for the creation of a new cloud category. And here with more is Gavin Prieder-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society, where, aside from other things, including writing the Cloud Spotter's Guide, they solicit original music inspired by clouds. Gavin, thanks for being with us.
Hi.
So what's the new cloud and what's the name? I hope it's as good as all the other names.
Well, the name is Aspiratus.
Nice.
Yeah, it sounds kind of official, doesn't it?
And what sort of clouds does it describe, or would it be?
It looks a little bit like as if you were underwater looking up at the surface of the sea, say, and it was a choppy, rough day, and the waves were all chaotic and turbulent above. That's the appearance, and the word, the Latin word, comes from aspero, which is to roughen or to agitate. The Latin poets used it to talk about a sea when, you know, in rough conditions.
All right, so the weather guy would say something, or gal would say, we've got aspiratus clouds forming, that means storms are coming, something like that?
Something like that, but it doesn't necessarily lead to storms. That's the funny thing. I mean, it's a rough and turbulent appearance, but sometimes it just passes and dissipates without a storm having formed.
So it's those nasty-looking, really gray, dark clouds that go to the top of the sky and down to the surface, but sometimes pass over.
Yeah, although, I mean, it's more a layer with a lot of sort of turbulent waves in it. And, you know, the really tall clouds are the cumulonimbus storm clouds. And, you know, if you're underneath one of those, there's no getting away from the fact there'll be a heavy storm.
Nimbus, that's a whole other deal for sure. Listen to this, won't you?
Would you like to come cloud watching with me? We can watch the
So, Gavin, that song was actually submitted to your Cloud Appreciation Society. It's by an artist named Abby Dobson from Sydney, Australia.
That's right. Yeah, and then we get a lot of the members send in art, and they send in their poetry, and a bit we've put up recently is music that has been that they've recorded, which has been inspired by clouds or watching the clouds.
Now, we all appreciate clouds, but why a cloud appreciation society?
Well, I think someone needs to stand up for them because, you know, certainly here in the UK, they get a bad press. I mean, people complain about them too. They say there are too many clouds around, and people talk about someone having a cloud hanging over them, a cloud on the horizon, you know, someone's vision being cloudy as opposed to having a sunny outlook on the world. And to me, I think clouds are one of the most poetic, beautiful, you know, changing, ephemeral parts of nature, one which everybody has a good view of, which is a great thing.
I hear
I
a song.
Celebrate.
I hear a song right there out of what you're saying. Gavin Prieter-Pinney, I hope they agree, whoever it is that will agree to name this new cloud. I actually love the name.
Good. I'm glad you like it. It's a World Meteorological Organization. We'll cross our fingers.
All right. We will all do that. Gavin Prieter-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society and author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking whether parents are entitled to monitor the websites that their children view online. Where is the line between being a good parent and invading a child's privacy? Discussions and debates now at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Flat opening on the market this morning. I'm John Hockenberry here on The Takeaway, and we're going to begin this segment with Femi Okeh's headlines.
Thank you very much. The time is just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Tonight, President Obama heads to the Middle East. He gave a speech in Cairo about American relations with the Muslim world. He also visits Saudi Arabia. Sunni leaders in the region are concerned about the rising influence of Shia-led Iran. The president talked about the state of nuclear talks with Iran with our partners at the BBC.
I don't want to put artificial timetables on that process. We do want to make sure that by the end of this year, we've actually seen a serious process move forward. And I think that we can measure whether or not the Iranians are serious.
On his way back, the president will stop in Europe to meet leaders there, visit American troops, and mark the D-Day anniversary. Now, France marks the 65th anniversary of D-Day this weekend with some very high-profile leaders on the guest list. Of course, President Obama will be there. Prime Minister Gordon Brown has an invite, but President Sarkozy didn't invite Queen Elizabeth II. Now, the omission has the British public livid. President Obama has stepped in to try and ease the tension between France and the UK and get Queen Elizabeth a personal invitation. His spokesman, Robert Gibbs, isn't taking the assignment seriously.
We are working with those involved to see if we can make that happen. Obviously,
wonderful.
She is somebody. will you please pass that directly to the Queen for me? Thank you.
I'm not too sure the Queen will be getting an invitation, but French officials say that they invited the British government and it's up to the British government as to who they send as a representative. Back in the United States, the State Department is pioneering the field of barbecue diplomacy, you could say. Our partners at the New York Times are reporting that American embassies around the world are receiving notice from Washington that it's okay to invite Iranian government officials to July the 4th cookouts. Embassies and consulates traditionally throw huge Independence Day parties, but Iranian officials have been barred since 1979 when diplomatic relations between the countries fell apart. And the Senate is back to work, and it's got a high-profile visitor today. Supreme Court nominee Sonia Sotomayor will meet with some top lawmakers. Now, this is something of a tradition for high court nominees. The administration wants to get Sotomayor confirmed before the Senate's August break, and Republicans say they don't want to rush the process. That's a look at your news for now.
Thank you, Femi. So abortion doctor George Tiller has been dead since Sunday, his suspected murderer already in custody. And Bill O'Reilly goes on the air last night at the top of his Fox TV show to say he didn't do it.
I knew pro-abortion zealots and Fox News haters would attempt to blame us for the crime, and that is exactly what has happened.
O'Reilly didn't kill Dr. George Tiller, he wanted us to know. All he did was talk about the abortion doctor on his show dozens of times.
Every single thing we said about Tiller was true, and my analysis was based on those facts.
Just the facts, Bill. Well, here's O'Reilly with one of his facts.
This guy operating a death mill, which is exactly what it is.
Well, the media reaction is all part of the aftermath of the Sunday morning murder of Dr. George Tiller, a Kansas doctor who is estimated to be one of about three who performs so-called late-term abortions after 21 weeks. Joining us now to talk about this, because the aftermath has been serious for healthcare professionals all over the country, are Dr. Bill Harrison, an OBGYN doctor at Fayetteville Women's Clinic in Arkansas, and Jeffrey joins us from Kansas City, a clinic manager at Aid for Women's Healthcare in Kansas City. Jeffrey, thanks for being with us. You don't want to use your full name, correct?
That's correct.
And it's something you don't even do at your clinic, right?
Normally not. It's just Jeffrey.
All right. To both of you, and I'll start with you, Jeffrey, did Dr. George Tiller take an explicit risk by being so public with both what he did and how open he was about his identity and his visibility in the community, Jeffrey?
Yeah, I think he took a risk, but he knew it just like I know my risks as well. I haven't quit working here.
So, Dr. Harrison, first of all, you're not choosing to be anonymous, and I'm wondering if you view this differently. And secondly, have you made any sort of changes at the clinic, at the women's facility in Fayetteville, where you work?
Well, I don't think that being open about what you do and talking about what you do and why you do it puts you at increased risk. In fact, I think it puts us at increased risk when we don't do that. If people don't know why we do what we do, they make all sorts of assumptions.
Have you made any changes at the women's clinic in Fayetteville where you work?
Well, several years ago, after my clinic was broken into and firebombed, we put up smoke detectors and we put a panic button in to notify the police if there was a danger. But no, other than that, we have not done anything.
Jeffrey, for you, is it a more frightening landscape today after what happened on Sunday?
Frightening is maybe a stronger word than I'd use. Worry, yes. I mean, we prepared about 2 months ago just because Obama was in office. We figured there'd be some kind of backlash. We've had lots of crank calls.
So you prepared for a backlash. You know, it seems to me that last night in listening to Bill O'Reilly, who I think was typical of some of the response to what's happened here, there was great pains made to say that the violence is condemned on his program. Yet he explicitly went out of his way to describe Dr. Tiller as a destroyer of thousands of fetuses who made millions of dollars doing that, and that what he did was, quote, within Kansas law. Now, it's my understanding that what he was doing was actually legal in Kansas. And how do you characterize this making millions from destroying fetuses characterization, Jeffrey? I mean, it poisons the environment in which you work, correct?
Yes. I mean, that's kind of a loaded question. I mean, we all make money doing what we do. I could say that O'Reilly makes millions of dollars doing the blasphemy that he spews forth, but, you know, we try to condemn it, but it doesn't stop it. I mean, I'm not going to attack the money issue, and as far as killing fetuses, that's a loaded phrase. I just say, you know, doing abortions or helping women. What was the last part of the question?
Well, no, I think you've answered it well. Dr. Bill Harrison, I mean, it was a concern of all of us here not to have any women voices in this segment, but I want to ask you, how does a woman find themselves in a situation where they might need a termination of a pregnancy after 21 weeks, in your experience?
Well, the problem for Dr. Tiller was not that he provided abortion after 21 weeks. There are hundreds of physicians around the country. Well, not hundreds, but there are dozens of physicians around the country who provide abortions after 24 weeks. I mean, after 21 weeks. Dr. Tiller's problem was that he provided abortions in the third trimester of pregnancy. And this is what put him at increased risk over many of us who had been providing abortions into the late second trimester. In Arkansas now, I can't do abortions after 19.6 weeks, I think it is. And so I don't, because you have to jump through a lot of hoops to go through Arkansas's laws.
But Jeffrey, you're in Kansas. How do you assure women that the law will be followed and that their health concerns will be uppermost in an environment where it sounds like they have every reason to fear?
You kind of lost me on the question. I'm sorry.
How do you reassure women this week that they have no reason to fear if they have health needs from your clinic?
I carry a weapon openly, so as far as, like, physical violence, I mean, I have that. Now, as far as trying to assure them that they will be able to get the care they need if they're beyond us, I can't do that. I had one yesterday who was canceled from Tiller, and I tried to tell her, well, she needs to go to New York or she needs to go to Boulder, Colorado, because it's not getting done anywhere close, and all she could do was cry, and I couldn't do anything to help her.
So you sent her away?
Yeah, I mean, she called from Wichita. She's 22 weeks, can't get it done here. She'd already been turned away by the other two clinics because of how far along, because they couldn't do it either. What can I do? I can't do bus fare to get her to Boulder, Colorado. She doesn't have money to go to Boulder.
Dr. Bill Harrison, before we go, and we really are down up to the end here, but that is such a provocative story. What do you say to the people who are listening to this story and might assume about that woman? Tough luck. You took too long for whatever reason. Tough luck.
Well, they don't know her story. Let me read you a poem that a friend sent to me last night. Where are you? When you were famous, when you were brought to us in shackles with an armed guard, or were terrified that you would run into one of your students. I remember each of you. Our clinic was firebombed, do you recall? Exhausted and terrified, we had been up all night. We rerouted you to another clinic because you wanted to do the abortion that day. Where are you? Priding ourselves on providing abortions for those who cannot pay, we spent millions of dollars that we really never had.
Well, it's all there in your voice, Dr. Harrison. Listeners can see all that poem on our website. Dr. Bill Harrison, OBGYN at Fayetteville Women's Clinic in Arkansas. Thanks to Jeffrey, also, who's just going by his first name, at the Women's Healthcare Clinic in Kansas City, Kansas. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.